Hey everyone, Blake Crash Priddle here, and welcome once again to The Medley. Today, us 90s kids are going to be reliving our childhood. We're going to be speaking with Adam Springfield, who was in the classic PBS kids show Wishbone. He's going to tell us how he got the role as David in Wishbone, and he's going to tell us some interesting behind-the-scenes stories, as well as what led him to pursue a career outside show business later in life. It's great to have you on The Medley this week, Adam. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Blake. Appreciate it.
Anytime. You know, I used to watch Wishbone all the time, so this is going to bring back a lot of good memories.
And for me as well. It was a pleasure to make that show, so I'm glad that it provided some good times for you as well.
Tell us about the audition process. Like, how did you land the role of David?
That was interesting. I actually remember going, it feels like a millennia ago now, with my mother to an audition. I had been acting for a number of years at this point, about maybe three already. And I remember going to, I believe it was KD Studios in Dallas, for the audition. And, met with the casting director, Rhody Kent, and auditioned well, and had a callback, I believe, at one point. And I remember really tanking the callback. I think I was super nervous. Must have been around 11 years old at this time, but just feeling like I had done really poorly. And we were really excited because this was a huge production, which is not something that came through Dallas very often. And so I remember asking my agent to see if there was any way they could let me try again. And I think they were interested in at least seeing me again. So I went back and did much better with, you know, having had a little bit more time with the script, I believe. And yeah, from there, I went and met not only producers, but the director, director of several of the episodes as well, Rick Duffield, I believe Jeannie Simpson or and Dora Simpson, her mother, I believe that were also sitting in. And I did really well. Not too long thereafter, was offered the role.
Before the audition, did they explain to you the concept of Wishbone? Because it's a very unique concept for a kids show.
You know, I don't believe so. Not in the initial stages. Once I was offered the role, they had a like a promo reel that kind of explained a little bit more of what they had in mind. It actually had the dog Soccer running around and the voice of Larry Brantley actually, you know, performing and doing like an intro essentially that I believe was used to pitch the show. So I did see that, but it wasn't until after I had joined the team as it was.
Because the best way to describe Wishbone is Wishbone observes the human characters in a certain situation, and then he imagines himself in a classic piece of literature in a similar situation.
That's a very succinct and very accurate way of how they described it as well. Yeah, very much so. The you know, the dog imagines himself as the main character in these classic tales, and then we would be the ones that would kind of portray a parallel story in kind of reality or you know, modern times. Kind of a way to introduce kids to classic literature by giving them, you know, an analogous story that they could relate to, which I think was brilliant. I don't know that when they were kind of, you know, brainstorming it, that it came together quite that way until certain people got involved in the process. But it was, very, very interesting how that came about. And I think quite brilliant.
Before we talk more about Wishbone, you mentioned that you had been acting prior to that. Did you have any roles in commercials, or were they in plays, or what kind of acting gigs did you have?
Yeah, mostly commercial work prior to. I had been doing a lot of modeling in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. By chance, to kind of explain my story of how I got into the business, was with my folks at my father's boss's party, of all things. He was working for British Airways at the time. And there was this lovely model in her early 20s who was modeling for Elite Dallas, one of the, you know, large agencies there, and suggested to my mom that my sister and I should definitely get our headshots taken, and that we would work a lot in the industry. And so she even knew of a up-and-coming photographer who was willing to, you know, do the photos with us on spec. And it went from there that a actual talent agent saw the photos, was interested in bringing me in, and sent me to New York, actually, for the IMTA, which is the International Modeling and Talent Association. So at the age of 8, I was dancing in front of 1,500 people for the finale of the dancing competition, amongst others, which included acting. There was a sitcom portion, a drama portion, and several other categories of competition. And ended up kind of walking away with, you know, several trophies and runner-ups and pretty much everything that I was engaged in. And coming back to Texas, from there, we really just kind of hit the ground running. Elite Dallas was interested in taking me on, and I had a wonderful agent who then got me really involved in modeling. Again, kind of the acting thing was a little bit more sparse in Texas. It's just kind of more local things that were offered. So I did, like, you know, a church's chicken commercial and a few other like a Ventures ad in stuff that was kind of somewhat related to modeling. But I did, you know, JCPenney catalogs for years and years, actually up until about the time that I really broke through with Wishbone and got the role as David Barnes.
What was the first day on set like? I must have been somewhat nerve-wracking, but also exciting at the same time.
Yeah, it was really, I just remember being thrilled throughout the process. They were wonderful in that they gave us some good coaching and just kind of, you know, the basics of being a thespian. And I would really credit that a lot to Doris Simpson. She was one of the producers on the show and sat us down and gave us great techniques for kind of being able to concentrate and shut out some of the, you know, the wild and crazy of the crew that were, you know, setting up the shots and all these things so that we could kind of concentrate on giving our best performances. And I just really remember being excited. I really have to think back because I'm wondering now which episode it even was. Because we did shoot in order. I just remember being excited and hitting the ground running. There was three kids. Jordan Wall played Joe on the show, and Christy Abbott was the actress who played Samantha on the show, Sam. And so I just remember us all being really excited and, you know, I think I was not ready for just how much of that waiting and delay there kind of was. You know, it wasn't similar to any of like the plays that I had been in church or anything like that. You know, the fact that you say action and then you say cut and you're stopped and you're waiting for another 30 minutes before you go to the next setup, was really fascinating to me. I don't think it was what I expected, really. It was just a really fun, interesting. I mean, it was surrounded by artists. I think they found every artist they could find for, you know, 100-mile radius in Dallas, Plano area, and everybody was just really charged up and excited that we had such a commitment already from PBS as well to shoot the full 40 episodes of the first season. That's kind of my recollection of the first days, was just being, you know, excited that we were going to be digging in, and but then also, like, you know, not used to being around these bright lights and, you know, just, you know, we shot everything on film. So he was much, much different than I think even some of the requirements these days, as far as lighting to pick up on things. So it was very kind of old school film style shooting, which is what probably actually, you know, increased the cost of the production of the shows, but I think also gave it a sense of quality and kind of lasting grandeur that I think made it, you know, be successful and on the air for so long.
Now, I previously had a conversation with an actor that was on the set of The Littlest Hobo, which is a Canadian show that is very similar to Lassie, about a dog that saves people. And he told me that because the dogs on that set were working dogs, they couldn't be bothered too much. Was that the same with Stalker the dog that played Wishbone?
Yes. So to a degree, you know, we wouldn't find ourselves just, you know, throwing the ball with him or anything like that. He had a pretty strict routine just to kind of keep him focused as well, to be able to perform on the camera and the certain tasks that may be required that day for shooting. So very sheltered, very, you know, they kept him as well as his, he had several stunt dogs. And so there was, you know, a full kennel and a team that worked with Jackie, who owned Soccer, in kind of like, you know, the mindset to be able to perform these tasks, because, you know, it was very much, you know, holding a treat. But they also had this very much a clicker that they could use that was associated with getting a treat that they used to kind of manipulate the actions of the dog to get what they wanted. And so, yeah, there wasn't a lot of like interaction between us, like hanging out with Soccer. I do remember being able to throw the ball like once or twice, but it was, you know, usually towards the end of the day, when he had already completed all the filming and, you know, they weren't going to need to get a shot from him. Cause he would do this, cute little, backflip. I think you may have seen it once or twice where he would kind of like run towards you and then do a somersault backward, more of like a twist, but yeah. And you could get him to do that with a ball if you threw it on the ground correctly. So that was fun. But yeah, he was very much a working actor and part of the cast in a lot of ways.
I remember seeing that cute little backflip, and I also used to like the way that he would crawl sometimes too. That always made me laugh when I was a kid.
Yeah, when he was sneaking into a location or a place. Yeah. Yeah, the amount of gestures and stuff that they would use was really interesting, because he just had such a vocabulary really to kind of do all of these tricks that, you know, they could just wave their finger, because they would just wave their finger and say speak, and they taught him to bark at that. But then they could be off camera and just be waving their finger and not doing the speak, this saying speak to him, and he would learn to, from that, to be able to do his bark. So,
well, to this day, Wishbone is still very popular among 90s kids. Did you anticipate that it was going to be a big hit?
I don't think that I did. Again, being in Texas, and I mean, we knew things that were on PBS, but some of them, you know, like Barney, which was also shot in Texas, actually, you know, they weren't necessarily super popular with my age demographic. So I don't think I anticipated it being quite as successful as it was. And I don't think that I was quite ready for that, especially once, you know, we had finished shooting and it finally released in 95, almost exactly 30 years now. So I was back in junior high. And since we were just the three kids on the show, we basically had one teacher that did our schooling for us. And so we, you know, took almost private schooling, essentially, just so that they could kind of work around the shooting schedules, et cetera, and make sure that we did enough hours as required by, you know, laws, the Screen Actors Guild laws, et cetera. Because of that, I was able to advance quite quickly. And, you know, you're just having that one-on-one attention. And so I had skipped a grade. And so going back to junior high, I was a year ahead of all of my other classmates. But then to have the show kind of break, and here I was, you know, should have been a seventh grader, but I was an eighth grader. And that's exactly when, you know, all boys start having their, you know, testosterone spurts and are growing and whatnot. It was challenging to have it come out and be so popular, and for me to experience a bunch of backlash and kind of, you know, jealousy that I wasn't expecting or ready for, really. So I didn't expect it to do that and to go into other markets. I mean, it was played pretty much anywhere PBS played in the English speaking world, which is, it was quite a vast set of markets. I don't think I quite expected it to go that big. We had grown quite a bit. There was a second season that was shot. I don't know how popular those episodes are, or how much they kind of got into maybe your purview, but so they introduced three new kids. And we were almost all teenagers at that point. I think I was 13 and Jordan was 14. Christy must have been about that same age as well. So we were, you know, our voices were changing, and there was, I believe, only 9 episodes that we shot. So quite a different setup. Several of the original writers were no longer involved in things, and it was a different phase and different experience, the second season specifically. You know, they started having Wranglers really kind of like clamp down on where we were, what we're doing, and such. And at that point, because the it just seemed to take a different turn as far as like the support that we were getting as actors. And I think it really prepared me for kind of, you know, the rough and tumble world of being an actor out on your own thereafter, because I did at least somewhat attempt a career acting for a number of years thereafter, until I was about 25. I was still pursuing my acting career.
Your character, David, is really good with fixing things and building machines, and he loves science and things like that. I was watching a video clip where he built a special surveillance tool or something to try to videotape evidence of a burglary or something like that. And I thought that was a really cool invention that he built. You know, at 12 years old, he was able to build such a cool invention.
Yeah. I appreciated those aspects of my character as well. I love that he was smart. He liked to use technology to kind of like help him and his friends do things. Built a snow machine and, you know, helped fix the lighting system in one of the theaters after having broke it, of course. But yeah, it was a great kind of aspect to that character that was somewhat in line with my own kind of, you know, personality. I very much enjoyed computers. And I mean, we're talking about a time when really the personal computer was just starting to come into people's homes, you know, and really be accessible. You know, we're talking about the days of dial-up. I'm totally dating myself, but I was, you know, engaged in those type of things and understanding technology and how it was going to change our world. And so, yeah, it was cool to have a character that was seen to be reflecting those same kind of interests.
There was one episode where David did something somewhat out of character when his father bought a new Mustang and David decided to start the car just to see how it sounded. And he accidentally backed it up and broke the mirror off the car. Do you remember that episode? I watched a little bit of it before we started recording.
Yeah, I do. I do. And it's partially because it was one of the ones that kind of featured my character. So required, you know, a little bit more attention for that week of shooting for me, as well as time. But yeah, certainly because also I was able to be in this really cool Mustang. It was actually the car of one of the art directors, I believe, Barry. And so, yeah, it was, you know, not operated by me at any point. Thankfully, they the way that they were able to do it with moving magic, they just kind of like had grips pushing the car and sandbags to stop it in the locations where I was supposed to be slamming the brakes. So I didn't really wreck the vehicle, thankfully. Yeah, it was a fun episode. I remember it because David did come up against the conflict of lying, you know, and being dishonest, and what that does. And then being ratted out by his little sister, or at least pressured, I think, guilt wise to do the right thing and come clean. Yeah, that was and the gentleman who played my father was a very experienced actor and was great to work with, as well as my sister in the show, played by Brittany Holmes. So yeah, it was a fun episode. That one I remember distinctly.
What I like about that David and Goliath episode, that was the one where you broke the mirror on the Mustang, or rather David did. What I liked about it was that it taught me to never, ever goof around like that with keys and an ignition, and it discouraged me from doing anything like that. I thought, okay, I am never, ever going to do anything like that, at least not until I'm 16.
And right. Well, here you have somebody who's, you know, somewhat proficient with machinery and stuff like that. And he's, oh yeah, I just need to pull up and blah, 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 you know, but no experience to back up kind of his knowledge about how to operate something and how that can get you into trouble. Right.
Yeah, although it was David's fault for what he did, I got to thinking that it was probably also a bad idea in hindsight for David's mother to leave the keys in the car, too.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and, you know, thankfully it was, you know, the kind of neighborhood where they felt free to do that. But yeah, probably not the best of ideas. It was a tricky situation. And it was really, I think... you know, that nagging sense from his little sister that kind of made him realize, you know what, it's probably better to come clean than to have her, you know, tell on me, get me into more trouble. But yeah, it was an experience and a life learning lesson for myself as well, without necessarily having to go through the trauma of being in trouble that way.
Well, I would say that David's parents actually went pretty easy on them. I mean, they only took away his computer privileges for a month, and they allowed him to babysit Emily again despite that, but said very clearly that if something like this ever happens again, then we're going to have to get a babysitter for both of you. I mean, lots of parents wouldn't even do that. They would just say, okay, that's it. No more staying at home alone for you. So I think they were pretty fair.
Yeah, no, definitely. pretty judicious with how they handed down the discipline on that one, for sure.
I love the dialogue that they gave for Wishbone in that scene as well. It was pretty cute and funny.
Yeah. And I remember that being a wonderful time and a great episode. It gave me a chance to kind of, spread my wings a little bit.
Did anything funny or memorable happen when filming Wishbone?
Well, there was definitely times when the dogs would pass gas or something like that brought everybody to cringe or run away, or, you know, want to have some fun levity around that. I do remember that. I do remember there just being kind of a fun, jovial spirit amongst the crew as well. Like, because there were so many of these old school clothesline clips that the gaffers and electricians would be using for, you know, various things that they would be, you know, roping or holding up lights with, I started to get in the habit of stealing them off of their belts as they would go by, and then finding somebody to clip the clothesline hook to their shirt. So it became a thing, and I would do that quite a bit. And there was like a lot of like really fun pranks and things like that. One of the cameramen, I remember, he had this great little kind of, I don't know if it will read, but into the mic, but he would be able to rub his hands together and make it kind of like a bug sound. And so, because of how we were set up, oftentimes I'd be off camera, but like just adjacent to the cameraman, so that the look lines from the other actors would be played to the right spot for their close up or whatever. And he would do this little bug noise in my ear. And it just, I didn't know where it was coming from. I'd look around and he'd be just both hands back on the wheels of the camera, not looking at all. And it took me, you know, I think halfway through the season before I realized who was doing it and where it was coming from. So that would be, you know, an instance of that. I remember some not so cool things too. We had two different locations really that we would shoot. So all of the exterior stuff was shot on a back lot. And it was in a different location from the actual studio where we had all the interior locations shot. And the back lot, as we called it, was kind of a miniature town. So it had all the facades of the actual neighborhood of Oakdale, the fictional town where we lived. And I actually was doing a shot and through the air, I was highly sensitive to poison ivy, got poison ivy, and it like wrecked filming because my face swole up so bad. It was, it put off filming for a few days, and we really had to like, I went and saw a doctor to get antihistamines and all this. So it was, you know, one of only like maybe 5 or 6 times in my life that I had gotten poison ivy, but one of the more memorable ones because it like really affected like all these people's jobs, and it was different, very, very different than, you know, just getting it on my knees when I'm out riding my bike or whatever with my friends, in that it affected everyone like that.
That's no fun, poison ivy. I never got it, you know, knock on wood, but my cousin did once before all over his legs, and it was not pleasant for him.
Yeah. It was really prevalent there in certain, you know, thickets and stuff in Texas. So, I found myself with more than 1 or 2 oatmeal baths as a cure. and I do remember, lots of pranks going back and forth. Kind of, you know, a little bit of rivalry between, the different departments. I remember, we were given the opportunity as kind of like a extended school project thing to create our own shields, which, you know, like a crest, because they had just done, I believe it was the Ivanhoe episode, and the prop department had made tons and tons of these. They were made out of just plywood, but, you know, life-size shields with 2 pieces of leather that you could strap your arm through and guard yourself with. But they were just given to us as, you know, a free for all essentially for us to paint, and create our crest. And I believe I still have it at my folks' place somewhere in storage, but, I went with this, kind of similar to the Taoist separation of black and white. I don't want to get too nerdy, I guess, but on the Dexter side was all white. And then the Sinister side was all black. Right in the middle was a dragon that had the opposite of those 2 colors represented. And it was pretty technical with the tongue sticking out in a triangular shape and very medieval. I remember that being a blast as well. Some of the fun things that I experienced just being around other artists that were really kind of letting go. I think it was really unique and an experience that I look back and cherish. I don't think too many people have, you know, the opportunity at such an early age to get a sense of just how difficult it can be, but also how rewarding it can be to be working and to be creative even, you know, in your working. So it was definitely something I look back and cherish and look fondly toward.
Speaking of difficult, were there any episodes that were difficult to film?
Plenty of them actually. you know, so we do a weekly turnover and you're on to the next episode. And I think specifically for various departments, you'd have, you know, kind of a bottleneck. I am, and we won our Emmy, and I think it was deservingly so, for the costume design that Stephen Cujay was the director of that department. And all the little, not only did he have to, like, you know, create a frock coat for Mr. Bagwell or this guy or whomever the characters may be, but then also had to do that for the dog and several for an episode. So being able to interpret, you know, this week, a 14th century garment to have on a dog. And then next week we're doing an 18th century one with a top hat and, you know, and still having to be able to turn these garments out and have them look as good as they did was definitely a pain point at times. Cause really only Soccer was like the only dog of the bunch of them that really didn't mind wearing clothing. The rest of them were like, oh, get this off of me. But they were often called in for stunts where Soccer would not like to deal with water. So they would bring the, you know, his stunt doubles in to do any type of swimming or that type of stuff. But I think also just we ran into issues. I remember with the very first episode, now that I'm bringing it back and kind of recalling it, with the special effects, because if I'm not mistaken, it was Oliver Twist. And so they're doing the like establishing shot of London, and the visual effects department worked tirelessly on that establishing shot. And, you know, this is really before CGI had really kind of taken off. So, I mean, they're just frame by frame, you know, going through in Photoshop and rendering out these, you know, each image of that move across the city. So, yeah, there was, you know, extreme challenges. I think this is kind of, we kind of led a little bit in blue screen technology and some of those changes that were starting to come into the industry in that regard. So a lot of it was us kind of bumping up and learning new ways to solve those problems. So for me, I think one of the most trying times I had was an episode in the second season where the dialogue had been written for me in a way that I just wouldn't speak. And it was kind of verbose and very kind of preachy, teachy. You know, it was a moment where we were revealing a statue of Wishbone. And I just couldn't get the dialogue to come out correctly, which was a problem I really hadn't had a problem with, you know, for the 44 plus episodes prior to this day. And so I was really struggling and we were on the back lot and there was, you know, time concerns because of light and this and that. And so I just kind of remember feeling a lot of pressure around that and really struggling to get the shots that day. And not feeling satisfied with my performance. And yeah, so there were days like that for sure.
Yeah, the reason that I asked about challenges of filming the show is because one episode that comes to mind is the one where Sam and Joe and David and Wishbone all went into a condemned barn to look for an antique horseshoe, and you guys ended up getting stuck in the barn, and the barn caught fire, and there were quite a few visual and special effects in that episode that looked quite expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and really realizing the difference between those two parts, right? Because the visual effects being kind of more the digital side of things, right? The things that you can kind of do in post versus the special effects department, which we really kind of handled things on the ground with smoke and poppers or explosions or, you know, those type of things. And kind of realizing they're very different approaches to kind of a cohesive idea of what you want to kind of present thereafter, and how they have to kind of work in tandem to get the effect and the desired end result was really interesting and eye-opening. That I kind of understood that filmmaking is very much a team effort, in a lot of ways, and how important everybody's job really was to make the whole thing work. Yeah, definitely great lessons to learn and see at a young age, you know, that when you can all put your mind to it, you know, there was a cohesion. And I think that group of people, the crew, are just amazing artists. And I was really fortunate to have that time with them. And so at a time when I was really so impressionable and able to kind of learn things that perhaps they weren't even trying to teach, but I just kind of picked up by osmosis, just being around that energy and exchange of ideas. It was really, really cool.
So after Wishbone and in your later years, you decided to retire from acting. What made you decide to pursue a different career path?
You know, I think it was a combination of factors. For me, it was, you know, here I was now 25 and things had changed quite a bit for me. I mean, in my early days, I was so fortunate to have, you know, my folks really supporting kind of what I was doing. My mom, being the stay-home mom that she was able to, you know, rush me off to auditions whenever, you know, they came up. And I would just do some light navigation work. And then I would be able to study my lines on the way to the audition. So then, you know, it's really fresh in my mind. And, you know, again, it's, you know, one or two times in Texas. We did occasionally come out to Los Angeles for pilot season thereafter. But then eventually moved to Los Angeles in 1996. So I was pursuing things from that point until I turned about 25, pretty vigorously, and started my own production company, which never really produced anything other than I did write a script when I was about 16 years old with a wonderful gentleman who had a career in writing musical theater. For many years, Thomas Royal, and that not coming really to any type of fruition, and kind of hitting the roadblocks of just being an actor in the city and having so much competition. All of a sudden, I'm going to auditions, and there's 30 of us in a room going for the role instead of just, you know, me and the four other kids that were acting in Dallas at the time. So you know, kind of coming up against that, and then, you know, becoming an independent adult and needing money and wanting money and just, you know, having to have something to support myself at the same time, as well as then, you know, get in the car and rush off to an audition if it came about and fight LA traffic to get there barely in time, and then be in a room with, you know, that much competition and no time spent really on the material that I would have liked to have, you know, been able to act properly. I think I started to just kind of get frustrated with the whole thing. I just really remember enjoying acting, and here I was doing all this business that had nothing to do with acting in order to kind of support it. And you know, I was successful. I did a few things. I was on a you know, a guest star role on JAG, Judge Advocate General, which was on Paramount, and. I did a movie called Roller Wheels. There was an AFI film that I did with Taraji Henson and Isaiah Washington called 1031. I just had some great other experiences, but very, very different from Wishbone, whereas, like, you know, you're doing an AFI film, it's on spec, there's not a lot of money behind it. You're dealing with, you know, CalArts students just students basically in general as the director and crew and everything. So the level of professionalism was just different as well. So then, you know, it's considerations of people's time and how much effort went around that. And it was just really a struggle. And though I loved it and I enjoyed the acting part and that type of creativity and interacting with different actors and just kind of what you can learn from them, I really, really remember taking away from Isaiah Washington just his severity and his ultimate focus when he was acting. Was just really inspirational and really cool. You know, Taraji was just an absolute blast to be with, and she played my sister in the film. And this is, you know, way before she, you know, blew up or things had changed. And I got to learn about Howard because, you know, being from Texas and then living on the West Coast, I really didn't know too much about the you know, Howard or that university and kind of its place within the Black community in the U.S. and its importance as a university. So it was, you know, still something that I was always constantly learning from. And I think what happened was I got to the point where I just wasn't having fun and doing it anymore. You know, the drudgery of kind of getting around and taking myself here to there and then having to hope that I could rush back and get to work on time just kind of killed it a bit for me as an actor. I feel like, you know, since then I've really tried to find avenues and places where I can express myself creatively, just because I feel like we all need that kind of outlet in some way. And it doesn't have to be necessarily something that's on show or display, but it's something that's kind of, I think, necessary just for a person to process and kind of get some of that stimulus and that energy, you know. To put it how my mom would say, you know, we're all parts of the creator, right? And so our very essence is to want to create ourselves. I think that's why we all have the drive to have kids and, you know, want to grow and multiply. And so at our very essence and core, there's a part of us that wants to create. And so I've been trying to search for that in other ways. And I think my early life as an actor kind of gave me a lot of tools to be able to try to find that for myself.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but for a while you worked in a hospital or something in Southern California, and now you're working as a tailor?
That's correct. Yeah. So I was so the parallel job that I had when I was very young and still acting in Los Angeles was first in hospitality. And so I was working in hotels, and I was at this great hotel on the Sunset Strip for like 10 years, not doing what you're supposed to do as an actor and being a bellman, but I'm actually part of the operations crew. And that's actually where I met my wife. And then about, I would say 2010 or so, I transitioned into healthcare and went and worked at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, which was a completely different type of experience. Partially moved away from hospitality was because my wife, who we started to date at that point, was moving up the ranks. And although she was my boss when we first met, which was also quite scandalous, she kept getting promoted. And it was just, I was trying to avoid any type of conflict of interest with that. So I really found an additional path with healthcare there. And I would say that was super informative and a great career as well. I was with Cedars for about 8 years and likely would not have left except for my wife dragged me away once again. She and I left for Washington, D.C. right as the pandemic hit. We spent like 9 months in the hotel that she was running. And during that time, I took the opportunity to study under a master tailor in Ireland, who was Savile Row trained and gave me the chance to, again, get very, very creative. And it was something that was kind of building in me for many, many years, I think partially, you know, being exposed to it with Wishbone and Stephen Cujet's incredible work really inspired me to kind of have this passion and love for costume. And, you know, I mean, it's something that's really been in me for a long time, even with the modeling days, always liking fashion or various things related to that world. I was able to kind of then get my hands on the tools to, you know, start creating garments that I was really interested in. And it had a lot to do with the fact that I also held this kind of mystique around the whole tailoring process. It's something that we don't have a lot of here in the States. it's kind of somewhat a dying art. It's coming back a little bit with the advent of social media and things. But yeah, that's what kind of was the impetus for that transition. I am no longer in Washington, D.C. We moved about 2 years ago, and I'm now here in Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm operating my little atelier out of our second bedroom here. And again, that move was precipitated by my my lovely wife, again, getting an awesome gig here in Tennessee.
So we're approaching the 30th anniversary of Wishbone. Do you still occasionally hear from fans that grew up watching the show? Or did you ever hear any fans say, I watched it a lot as a kid and now I'm introducing the show to my kids?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's happened occasionally. You know, it's been sprinkled throughout the years, and it's less likely these days. I think it's partially because I don't look quite like that little boy anymore that people would necessarily make the correlation. So I'm kind of saved from that aspect. I have had people come up, and once they find out, a lot of times it's really well received, and I do get complimented on the show and just kind of what it meant to those people. I think it's one of those shows that, because it's PBS, right? It just kind of feels different than all the rest of those shows. When you're not, like, you know, every 10 minutes being blasted with, some kind of, you know, the selling of some type of product, you know, it kind of sits different. It kind of almost sits like a movie. I would say, I feel like, certainly the amount of production value we put into each episode that, each one can kind of stand alone as such. And so, yeah, I think it really resonated and stuck with a lot of people. I mean, for me, it certainly gave me an edge up on my, my literature classes, you know, going into school, thereafter having, you know, these synopses of this great literature work, in my head already, certainly, you know, was a boon. And I think other folks too, you know, not necessarily that they got like a Cliff's note, but having some type of introduction and some kind of way of accessing, that same piece in a reflective different way than just, you know, being handed the text, kind of was beneficial for them as well.
Well, I do know that a lot of PBS shows like Arthur and Reading Rainbow encourage children to read as well. And as a result, book sales apparently went up. So I would wager that Wishbone probably contributed to that as well.
Well, I would hope so. Yeah. In fact, there was actual some spin-off books that were done in the likenesses of the characters. I think my mom still has a few of that hit the bookstore at some point. I don't think we even realized it because of, you know, just some of the things that you learn in business as well going along. I mean, here we were rather naive, you know, first-time kind of actors really in Texas. And so with the whole project, they did a massive buyout, essentially, PBS did, and hence its availability. You know, I mean, the reason probably why it's been on the air for a number of decades, you know, now is the fact that they bought us out, and with that came like all the, you know, the characters and their likenesses and stuff. So all of a sudden we'd be in a bookstore and notice my mom did that, you know, there was some Wishbone books. Oh, look, that's you on the cover. And it was just, you know, something I had never posed for or, you know, even knew about in any regard. And here's a book that's, you know, about my character. So yeah, that type of thing would occur. And definitely, you know, there's a certain kind of cutoff between, I think, maybe like people in their maybe mid-30s or so, I think is probably where I'm guessing is the cutoff point. But I don't know. I keep finding that there's younger and younger fans because it's been on for so long and is still so accessible. I mean, my niece, you know, my sister still plays episodes for her, and she enjoys watching me. And she, you know, will ask me very similar questions to what you did. Like, well, so soccer, did he like stand there and, you know, did you play with him at all? And so, yeah, there, you know, I don't know exactly where I was going with that, but yeah, I do occasionally get folks that will recognize me from the show. But it's becoming less and less. And it's more so after conversation. You know, sometimes I'll mention, you know, that when I was younger, you know, I was an actor or something like that to people, and they'll be curious about it and maybe ask. And then, cause I don't go around like, you know, broadcasting that's, you know, something I was involved in or did, while I'm very proud of it and enjoyed the experience immensely. You know, there's also like some associated traumas with just like having to deal with, you know, fame at a really early age in some ways. And it wasn't, I'm very grateful that it wasn't like huge, huge fame. But you know, I was living in Saginaw, Texas, which I think had a population of like 2,500 people at the time. So, you know, any type of you being on television regularly was all out stardom, for the folks around there. Just how people would treat you differently, because of that, really affected me in some kind of ways that I didn't expect and don't really like. And I don't like how fame kind of like affects how people treat people. Yeah. So, you know, there's that aspect, I guess, as well.
Well, I'm 31 and I started watching Wishbone when I was about 4, and, okay. I really enjoyed watching it, you know, up until they stopped airing it. I was in grade 2, I think, but I caught a rerun of it. You know, they brought it back to PBS on reruns, I think, in 2007 or 2008. And I remember seeing the kids on the show then. And I thought, they look so much younger than what I remember, because I was just a little kid when I first saw it.
Right. They were the big kids then, right?
That's right. They were the big kids. And now I'm a big kid. I'm 13 now, and
totally.
It was, brought back memories to see it, though. I mean, I was just channel surfing once. I was about 13, and it happened to be on. I thought, oh my god, Wishbone is on. I haven't seen that in years. I'm gonna watch that.
Yeah, it's so funny. And you know, there was a little bit of controversy around some of them. I don't know, like. Some of them didn't make broadcast like multiple times because of complaints from parents. I don't know if you had the chance to see, but there's an episode that we did around the Frankenstein story called Frankenbone. And because the makeup that they had done on the Frankenstein monster was so kind of like realistic and that it scared multiple kids. So, you know, their complaints to PBS made it such that they pulled that episode entirely and wouldn't air it. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting to find out, you know, certain things like that, that, you know, if you're a fan of Wishbone, there's probably a likelihood you may not have seen that episode. And, you know, for yourself in that you probably saw them, you know, for the first time at a much younger age, that was probably pulled from the shelf long before you started watching. So yeah, it's interesting to know which episodes did make it and which ones are on, you know, high repeat. I would be interested to find out a little bit more about that information, but I'm sure it's long past me being able to pry into those type of numbers. but yeah.
This last question that I have is about services like PBS and other publicly funded media. A lot of politicians want to defund PBS, or up here in Canada, CBC and other public broadcasting services, which is unfortunate. Do you think it's still important that we have public media like that, you know, especially ones that provide good educational programming and good news programming?
Well, I think you'll definitely find me on the side of supporting that. Absolutely. I think that, you know, having a place where creatives and even others, you know, just Antique Roadshow or any type of like, you know, cool, fascinating things that you'll find on those stations are definitely things that benefit society. yeah, I would highly encourage them. I don't support, you know, defunding and getting rid of, you know, the Department of Education, just to point out one, or, you know, or any of these other things that kind of add some kind of levity and cohesion and, you know, just the things about some of the traditions that we bring forward. I think there's often a disconnect and kind of a bit of incontinuity of those elements in our culture. And I think that definitely public broadcasting is one of those threads that tries to carry those through. And so I would definitely say that I'm supportive of public broadcasting. And I was very grateful to PBS for them also coming back, you know, an additional round of episodes, even though our costs per episode were so high and it was an, you know, enormous amount of, you know, production dollars put towards each episode. I think that there was some value, and I think that it gave a lot to a lot of folks. And so for that, I'm very grateful, not only to be on the receiving end of, but to have been a part of as well.
Adam, it was fun doing this interview this week, reliving childhood memories and hearing about your memories on the set of one of my favorite childhood shows. You know, thank you so very much for joining us, and I wish you all the best with your future endeavors.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Blake. It was a pleasure.
And that was Adam Springfield, former child actor from the TV show Wishbone. I hope that you enjoyed this week's edition of The Medley, and remember, we're all kinds of different.